Welcome to episode 37 of the Wake Up Podcast. On this ep, I've got Stefan Kinsella on with me. And Stefan's a patent attorney, but I guess more interestingly to me, he's what I would say probably one of the best thinkers and minds in the ANCAP libertarian space at the moment. I first heard him on Jimmy Song's podcast, I think, kind of mid-2020. Somewhere around there, and I heard his position on intellectual property, which for me, I mean, I've always had a view on intellectual property as an entrepreneur, as something that is not overly helpful because, you know, it depends on how much money you really have in the bank to fight a claim. So I never saw it as something very, I guess, effectual. But Stefan's position was that intellectual property, goes against natural property rights and the libertarian ANCAP position, which for me was a little bit foreign, having come from, you know, reading a lot of Rand's work and things like that. So anyway, I've wanted to get Stefan on for a long time, and, you know, in recent times he's become much more of a Bitcoiner, and, you know, really come to the same conclusion that a lot of Bitcoiners have, which is, you know, Bitcoin actually does fix things, because it is, you know, it's the thing that breaks the monopoly on money, and the monopoly on money enables bankrupt institutions like the governments all around the world to function. So, you know, in Bitcoin succeeding, it takes the world more towards an ANCAP libertarian reality. So anyway, this episode's super educational, one of the ones that I've learned the most from. Stefan is a brilliant mind. He explains the difference between, you know, property, possession, ownership. We sort of dig into Rand's ideas, what was consistent, what was useful, what she sort of fell flat with, and all sorts of things. So I think we're going to have to do a second round because there was just so many things that we could have dug into. So hope you enjoy this. As usual, subscribe to the channel, share it around, and I hope you enjoy it. And we're live with episode 37 of the Wake Up Podcast. And the fine gentleman we have here, smoking his pipe, is Stefan Kinsella. For those who don't know him, he's a patent attorney in Texas, the best kind of Austrian, the ANCAP kind, and someone who's been writing and sort of doing like a lot of thinking and discussion in this space for many years. So thank you for coming on, man.
Glad to be here.
Fantastic. Look, let's dive straight into one thing which always fascinates me is the breadcrumbs or the journey about how someone finds Austrian Econ and ANCAP. So I actually found it through Bitcoin. So my journey was a little bit asked backwards for, you know, what I guess most people's journey is. So I'm curious to sort of hear about your early inspirations, and sort of what led you down this path, because I think that's, for me, I find that really, really fascinating.
You might like, there's a book by Walter Block called, it's something like I Chose Liberty, something like that. And it's basically an assortment of stories from libertarians about how they became libertarians. It's interesting. I have a chapter in there, and mine is called I think How I Became a Libertarian. And I have that on my website. So that kind of goes into my story. But basically, I came from like nothing in the sense of political ideology. I was just like a young kid in high school interested in, you know, science and philosophy and all kinds of things. And so a teacher recommended that I read Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead. And when I read that, I got interested in philosophy and libertarian sort of pro-capitalist free market thinking. And then she recommended like Henry Hazlitt and Mises, I think, in some appendix. So I read Hazlitt, and then that led to eventually Rothbard and Milton Friedman and all that. So I developed a strong interest in economics and sort of as a supplement to explaining how freedom works. Then I went to engineering. I was an engineering undergrad. So that's really more math and natural sciences type thinking. So I didn't really have much exposure officially to all the economics and history and political theory and philosophy. So I kind of did that on my own. And then when I went to law school, I learned a little bit more. So that was my journey. And I just started being more and more strongly interested in it. I started writing a little bit in college. And then when I got out of law school and started practicing, I started writing more and more like in the academic realm for Mises Institute publications and law reviews and other things like that.
Okay, let's just sort of pull on some of those earlier threads. So how old were you when you first read Fountainhead?
Like 10th or 11th grade, so 15.
Yeah, okay.
Something like that.
Okay. Yeah, man, holy crap, that's a blessing. That's you know, the world needs more teachers like that, because I think when I was sort of 22, I first got exposed to Ayn Rand's work, but exposed in the sense that my girlfriend's dad was reading it at the time. But I, you know, being a young dumb shit, sort of following my own passions and business and stuff like that, I never actually read it to my everlasting, I guess, regret. Like the first time I read Atlas Shrugged was only, I think, 3 years ago. And I think Ayn Rand's work was some of, you know, the more powerful out there. So what do you think gave, so aside from the teacher recommending that, like, you know, teachers recommend shit all the time, like, A, why did you,
I think she, you know, I mean, I think she, well, first of all, I think that this was like the early 80s, right around the time when Rand died. And I was in Louisiana and I was at a Catholic school, and just the librarian there knew that I read a lot and we talked a lot. So she just assumed I would like that. And she was right. And at that time, I think Ayn Rand always was the biggest hook or intro to libertarianism. I think nowadays it's broader, and like Ron Paul sort of became the new guy. Mm-hmm. There's always Milton Friedman. So it was really Friedman and Rand and now Ron Paul type. And that attracts different types of people. You know, the Ron Paul movement attracts like younger activist types, maybe not really as intellectual. So they don't read as much. They watch YouTubes and they go march and they do political politicking. So it's a different crowd now. It's bigger, but kind of a different quality, in a way more radical than the old days. More people were minarchist in the old days, but they were more intellectual and scholarly. So in my own particular case, and by the way, perversely, I dislike the Fountainhead now, because I'm so against patent and copyright, and the whole theme of the whole plot of the Fountainhead is some guy blowing up a building. I mean, Howard Roark is like a misanthrope. He's an IP terrorist, I now believe. So the Fountainhead is not libertarian at all. I think it's actually a horrible, I mean, it's got some good individualist ideas, but they're kind of perverse, because this guy is like a loner, doesn't have a history, doesn't have healthy relationships, hates his clients. I mean, it's something weird about the whole book. So I still don't quite understand why it's such a good hook. Atlas Shrugged is way better. It's way more of a blueprint for liberty.
Thank you. Thank you. But, I 100% agree with that.
But anyway, I think for me, it resonated because I was like in the rural South. I was sort of a loner because I was a bookworm. And I was also adopted. And because I was adopted, I never really had this idea that my heritage matters. So I sort of like, I have to make it, you know, I'm like, I'm my own man. I started from nothing in a sense, you know, I have no history, no past. So I have to make it on my own. So I had this sort of independent spirit, which is sort of what Rand appeals to, right? She talks about, you know, you come from nothing and you make your way in the world. So I think it resonated with me because I had this rejection of this baggage of ancestry and heritage. And so I was like, I couldn't take credit or celebrate my, you know, Black pride or Hispanic pride or my British lineage. I was just nothing. So I was like, fuck it, I'll be anything. So I think that's why it resonated with me personally.
That's super interesting. So I've got a similar story in that sense. So, you know, having grown up with migrant parents in Australia, but I left home when I was really young, and I actually changed my name. So my surname Svetsky in my language means of the world. And I grew up in a very patriotic sort of family. You know, my uncle was really, you know, a Macedonian historian and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And he was sort of pushing me along the way of wanting to grow up and become the leader of Macedonia and, you know, take down the government and bring it back to its former glory and all this crazy shit, right? And I kind of broke out of that with some early reading, and it wasn't really libertarian reading. But what broke me out was this sort of my natural individualist nature, but sort of my desire to go down the entrepreneurial path more than anything else. And I kind of, you know, an early book for me was like, as trite as it might sound, but like Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And then I kind of went down that path. And yeah, I moved out of home when I was young and I changed my surname. So I kind of like wanted to depart from family, broke my lineage and built sort of my own empire myself. And I think that's, there's sort of those ingredients, which is, you know, really interesting for me here, listening to you say what those base ingredients were for you. But I think the libertarian path really requires, I guess, or that there's at least the correlation with being a bit of a lone soldier or a thinker or someone that has to have had done it for themselves. So I think that's interesting.
Well, yeah, and you have to. So I think that's sort of the psychological motivation for some people, or the hook that gets you in, explains why you're interested. And you also have to have a certain degree of self-confidence and independence to buck to buck the prevailing wisdom. And then you also have to have a certain degree of passion for truth and consistency and a certain degree of intelligence, because you have to, like, I mean, once you are, if you're not a misanthropic person, like if you care about yourself and the rest of humanity, and you just want the best for everybody, which most people would say that they do, as long if you have a little bit of economic literacy, which most people do not, right? If you just read economics in one lesson, that's basically all you need. If you have that, and if you try to be consistent in your thinking, then you can't help but come to basically libertarian conclusions. So you just have to care about intellectual consistency, be willing to think, read a little bit, learn a little bit, and then you'll be a libertarian. I think most people are soft or weak libertarians, and they would be stronger if they had time to care about consistency and to be principled, basically.
I think the consistency is, so I always say, like, the libertarian position is the only really consistent position of all of them, because wherever you diverge, you end up creating contradictions. You know, like I was actually on a date last night with this girl, and she was kind of talking about herself and how she's very individualist and all this sort of stuff in terms of her personal life, you know, and she's sort of like, when I was young, I wouldn't show my parents my grades if they told me, but I would just show them when I wanted to, because they were mine and it was my choices. And I was like, I told her, I said, you know, you're a natural libertarian, you're a natural individualist. Yeah. But then later on in the discussion, she's talking about how, you know, I'm a bit of a socialist because I believe in wealth redistribution, all this sort of stuff. And I'm like, fucking, you know, there's just absolutely no thinking happening here. And there's no consistency across how they want to behave for themselves, but then how they believe everyone else should behave.
Well, you know, we're social creatures, right? So we learn a lot from osmosis and from what people do, what they tell us, and that's natural and unavoidable. And the way society is now, you're gonna absorb a lot of, I mean, this is a total tangent. You're like I've come to the realization that alcohol is like a complete poison and a horrible thing. I mean, I was normal. I quit several months ago. I learned about it. I quit drinking because I realized how bad it is. Like, it's a total poison. I'm not on an alcohol spiel, but the point is, people think it's normal because everyone does it, right? And if you challenge someone's belief, they'll just start getting defensive about it. Well, no, it helps you relax, or it's good for your heart, which is all bullshit, right? But the point is, you hear these things, right? And the same thing with the state, of course. Like, people, I mean, in most countries outside the U.S., they're used to socialized medicine, and they can't even imagine what it's like to have a free market in medicine, right? Most people can't imagine having a private road system. They're just used to it. So they try to fit things together that are not really compatible because they don't know what else they can do. And so then someone like us who tries to be consistent, they will accuse us of like being autistic or something, or like being obsessed.
Or extremists.
They'll trot out that stupid who is it that said of foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, which is just an excuse to be inconsistent, right? Because you're too lazy to try to figure out how to, like, if you have two views that are contradictory, at least one of them is wrong, right? So you need you need to figure out which one is wrong, or maybe they're both wrong, but at least one of them is wrong.
That was one of Ayn Rand's beautiful things, I think. This is why I love Atlas Shrugged so much, is, you know, the whole A is A and, you know, contradictions don't exist. And she was sort of, Yeah.
But of course she didn't stick to it. I mean, she's not human. So she was inconsistent on parts of her rights theory and her advocacy of intellectual property, and also on her opposition to aggression and her opposition to anarchy. So like they're both in tension with each other. So she couldn't quite go all the way, but at least she tried, you know, she tried to be consistent. I think Rand is like a really good entree, but you need to move past it at some point. Otherwise you're going to be an objectivist, cultist. Like I sort of was for a few years. I mean, you got to have strong enough fortitude to break out of it at some point. By the way, that Kawasaki guy you mentioned, I used to have mildly positive thoughts about him from what I heard about him. But I heard him on a Bitcoin thing. I think it was
with the Safe. Clown.
He's an idiot. I mean, he's a total idiot. I couldn't believe it. And I read a review that someone said his book is just full of totally trite advice. Now, maybe simple trite advice is what you need at some point, but he just seemed like a complete arrogant and non-serious clown when he talked to Safe.
He's a Looney Tune, man. He's a Looney Tune. So when I was, you know, I was, when I read his book, I was 16, you know, so, and I'd sort of not understood. His basic trite advice, I will give him credit where credit's due. He managed to distill like entrepreneurial concepts into like some nice diagrams and shit like that, which makes sense for a young person to think about how to be, you know, why is it better to be an entrepreneur or an investor than it is to be a fucking employee? You know, and so that was useful. But what I actually found out, so funny story, this is unrelated to, related to Kiyosaki, but unrelated to the conversation, is I found out many years later that he actually stole all of his material from another guy called Keith Cunningham, who's the actual sort of real deal. So the archetype of the rich dad was this guy called Keith Cunningham, who Kiyosaki was kind of like a helper at one of his courses and basically ripped off the information and repackaged it and sold it under his own banner. Which
by the way, I have no problem with that whatsoever, except, you know, you should acknowledge your sources if it's blatant and obvious. You should just be honest about it, you know.
Correct. And that's what I think, you know, Kiyosaki, where he falls over is that he acts like it's all his, where it's sort of like he acts like he fucking knows it all, but he doesn't. He's just sort of he's a very good marketer, but he's a dumb shit. So it's a like, I think we're drowning in those kind of people in this world anyway. I think in a very fiatized world, we've got snake oil salesmen. And
Ayn Rand did that too, to a degree, right? She acted like she was the creator of all this body of this integrated, sort of integrated, comprehensive body of philosophy, right? That encompassed ethics and epistemology and metaphysics, philosophy, even aesthetics, and of course, politics and economics. And she did cobble together a nice little body there with some holes in it and some problems, but she drew from other people. She kind of admitted that, but she got pissed off when like Rothbard left her orbit and started kind of preaching his own version of some of the stuff he learned through her group, and she accused him of plagiarism for not footnoting her. And so he went and footnoted the original guy she had learned from just to, you know, like, so she learned it from Aristotle, he got it from her. He would just cite Aristotle, you know, and it would annoy her that so the Randians are weird because they hate the libertarians. They say that they're not true objectivists, or they're not even true libertarians, because they don't have a moral foundation. They don't want to be associated with them, and yet they're pissed off at us for not giving her enough credit for our ideas. It's like, well, which one is it? Why do you want us to give you credit if you are embarrassed by us being associated with us, you? Yeah, I mean, which one is it?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, to tie off the Rand topic, for me, what I think her greatest contribution, well, and maybe not greatest, but one of the most profound pieces for me was how she managed to weave all those things you mentioned into an actual narrative that was captivating. Like, it's a really, 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 really good story. And I think that is... for me, super unique in the world, because, you know, most other works are, you know, are works of like, you know, theory or philosophy or something like that. But she actually managed to weave it into a story, which I think was
She thought of herself as a novelist first and a philosopher second. Like she came up with a philosophy to make the novels good. So, but the novel way, the story way of portraying her ideas was good. Yeah, I agree. She was an impressive person. I do think she's the fountainhead, so to speak, of the libertarian movement. She did create it, basically.
Powerful woman, powerful woman. So, okay. So the questions that I had here were sort of, you know, why or how you became a libertarian. So, so I guess your journey then was kind of Randian initially, and then you said Hazlitt. So you kind of went Austrian economics, and that sort of libertarianism may have emerged after that in terms
I was libertarian. I mean, Rand's politics is what we would call minarchist or night watchman state or limited government libertarianism, even kind of constitutionalist. So I accepted her. I thought she was right in her critique of libertarians. Like, even though they sounded identical to her political philosophy, and I mean the minarchist libertarians, she said they weren't. So I just assumed she was right. But the more I read their pamphlets and things on at college, I said, they're the same as your philosophy. And I also accepted her critique of anarchy. And I accepted her argument for intellectual property at first, because I she was so good on other things, I assumed she was right. So I started to realize, the first thing I said was, well, she's wrong about libertarians. They're identical to her political philosophy. So I started becoming a libertarian, but I was hostile to anarchists. But then I read the Tannehills and Rothbard, David Friedman, people like that. And I finally realized, and Robert, even Nozick, who's not an anarchist, but he may be, he made me an anarchist in a way. So then I finally said, look, Rand is wrong about anarchy. I became an anarchist. So it wasn't Austrianism. Yeah. It was really the radical politics of Rothbard and those kind of guys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you've read Rothbard and you're not a fucking anarchist, you don't get it. But I think that's one of the things. Like, he's, for me, I was talking to Jimmy Song about this. Like, for me, Rothbard is like the most consistent philosopher that I've ever come across. Like, his work for me has been some of the most consistent, on point, like, ruthless that I've ever read. So
He's great on economics, he's great on methodology of economics, he's great on political philosophy and libertarianism. He's even good on history. Yeah, he's amazing. He's the central libertarian figure, I believe, in modern libertarian thought.
100% agree. So I actually want to get you to talk me through Rand's critique on anarchy and Rand's critique on or Rand's support of intellectual property, and then I want to sort of use that as a segue into your current position on intellectual property and things like that. So maybe let's start with the anarchy piece.
Well, I hate to psychologize, but I sort of think maybe what happened was her mistakes on both those areas were because, you know, she left the Soviet Union, which was horrible. She came to the U.S., which was infinitely better. I actually believe that. I'm not an America hater. I mean, I know we have problems, but so she came here and understandably loved the country. And so she loved the Constitution, because the Constitution, for all its flaws, sounds libertarian-ish compared to the Soviet Union, right? So I think she did what I did with her. Like, I took for granted that she was right on the areas I wasn't clear about. So she just took the Constitution as a blueprint that was basically correct. I mean, she wanted to correct a few things. If you remember the end of Atlas, she has Judge Narragansett striking out a couple things, amending it, making it perfect. But the idea is that it's almost perfect already. And of course, the Constitution is minarchist at best. I mean, it supports a government. You need a government, but it's limited to do its proper functions. And it also has patent and copyright in there. So she came over here and she thought that, well, to have a free society, you need a limited government bounded by a constitution, and you need to have patent and copyright laws. That's part of capitalism, right? So then she came up with an apparatus to argue for all that. And so for intellectual property, she weaved it into her rights theory, and she made the mistake most people make, which is she over-relied upon the Lockean idea, which is the Lockean idea is that we own property because it's unowned at first. God gave the world to us in commons. You own yourself, you own your body, you own your labor because you own your body. And if you go out and use things in the world, you mix your labor with those things and you stamp upon it your personality by mixing your labor with it. So you're mixing with this unowned thing some stuff that you own, and therefore you own it. That's sort of the metaphorical imagery he gives, mm-hmm. which is a colorful argument. I think it's not rigorously correct. I mean, the conclusion is correct, but it's not because you own your labor, right? And you don't literally mix your labor. That's just a pedagogical explanation. What it really means is you transform an unknown resource and you put a border up, which is a visible public link between you and that resource, which distinguishes that resource from everything else. And it provides a public guidepost to everyone else that now you're using and claiming this thing, and you have a better claim to it than them because you used it first. That's all it means. And I think that argument is correct. But to say that you own it because you own your labor and you mix your labor with it is not technically correct. But once you believe that, then you start thinking of labor as something that you own. Okay. And once you believe that, then you can make the argument, well, if I can own a tangible scarce resource by mixing my labor with it, according to Locke, but I can also create other things that are valuable to me, like ideas and inventions and novels. And if I expend my labor to create those things, then I own those things too, because you obviously own whatever you create with your labor, you see? And that's wrong. That's a mistake. I've criticized that before in speeches, but that's a fundamental mistake, and that's absorbed widely in the West, and it permeates all of political theory. I actually think it led to the labor theory of, so that's called the labor theory of property of John Locke. And then that sort of morphed and led and turned into the labor theory of value of Adam Smith, and then Ricardo, and then Karl Marx. So this whole labor theory of property and labor theory of value is basically the underpinning of socialism and communism, right? It's the idea that you own your labor, and when you expend your labor, you get some property right out of it. So like a worker on an assembly line puts his labor into building a product for the employer. The employer then sells that product for a profit and only pays the employee a wage, and the employer gets the surplus profit. But because that profit came from the labor mixed into the object, which was produced by the employee, it's a type of theft of his labor. That's the whole Marxian theory, right? So it's wage theft. So he's being exploited because he's being stolen from, right? Which is false, but it's based upon this labor theory. And Ayn Rand had that too. She thinks that if you labor on something, if you create it, then you own it, which is just not true. The way you own things is you find it or you buy it from someone who owned it. That's it. Creation is not a source of ownership. This is a fundamental mistake everyone makes. Creation is a source of wealth. So like creation just means transformation. It means you take up an object that you own. So you already own it either by contract, like you bought it from someone else, or you found it in the wilderness unowned. You have that natural resource, that factor of production, and you use your effort and your intellect and your labor to transform it into some more useful configuration. You rearrange it basically. And when you do that, you create wealth, because now that thing is more useful. So you've increased your wealth in the world because you can sell it for money or you can use it yourself, right? If you transform metal into a plowshare, now you can till your fields more efficiently, et cetera, right? If you make a fishing line, you can catch fish that way, right? Or a fishing net. So creation is not a source of ownership, but people think it is, because when you apply your labor and effort and you create, you're usually more wealthy, and they conflate that with ownership. But you own the things that have been rearranged. And by the way, this is speaking of consistency. Ayn Rand has some passages where she says, we don't really create things metaphysically. We just rearrange them. And we make them more useful to us. And Mises and Rothbard say the same thing. And they're correct. But then she says, well, if you create something, you own it. So she talks about creating values. We own values that we create. So she conflated, she says the purpose of life is to create values. Now that's a weird way of expressing the idea that the purpose of life is to achieve your ends, right? To seek ends and to try to use means rationally to achieve them, which is correct. But it doesn't mean these ends are values. It means you value the ends. So Mises was better on this, right? For him, value is a subjective phenomena. You demonstrate that you value something by acting to achieve it. But it's not like the thing has a value inside of it, which is the mistake that, like, say, Peter Schiff and others make when they criticize Bitcoin.
The intrinsic value stuff, yeah.
Yeah, they say gold has intrinsic value, but Bitcoin doesn't. Well, nothing has intrinsic value, right? we value things. So you got to think of value as a verb, not a noun. Things don't have value. We value things by our actions. And by the way, Ayn Rand recognized this when she said value is something that you act to gain and or keep, which is perfectly consistent with Mises' idea of demonstrated preference, that you demonstrate that you value something by acting to achieve it. But it's not like the thing has value inside of it, right, in an objective way. So these mistakes on labor and the source of rights and the nature of value is what led her to make a mistake in thinking that if you create some useful idea, which Rothbard would call a recipe, right? So you have to think of human action, which is what Mises calls praxeology, the study of the science or the logic of human action. Everything, and it's very simple. It sounds daunting, but it's not. It's just a complicated word he came up with, praxeology, which means the logic of action. Every human action, everything we do, is basically looking at the world, imagining the future that's coming, being dissatisfied with what we think is happening, and we try to interfere with the course of events to change things. To do that, we have to interfere with cause and effect laws, causal laws. To do that, we have to use scarce means that have an effect. So you use a tool, you use an object, you grab it, you manipulate it with your body, and you do something that changes the course of events. So all human action is the use of scarce means to try to achieve an end. That's what it is. An end is a goal. And sometimes that goal is to achieve the ownership or the control of a scarce resource. Like, I make a net to catch a fish. That's the goal of my action, is to have a fish. And really the goal of that is an intermediate goal, is to feed my hunger that I foresee is coming, right? It's not really the fish. The fish is a means for my hunger. And sometimes it's something intangible, or it's just a state of affairs. It's not even an owned thing. Like, if I want to have a wife or get a girlfriend, like you did last night, you took a girl on a date to have the company of a woman. You didn't acquire an owned thing. You don't have now an owned experience. You have a memory of an experience, and you have a relationship you've built, but you don't have an owned thing. So the end of that action was something different than acquiring ownership of a thing. Anyway, I'm on a tangent now. That's actually relevant for the mistake people make when they argue that intellectual property is legitimate because ideas are ownable because people buy them. So they make the mistake that if you sell something, that means you had to own it. But that's not true, because selling just means you got money in exchange for doing something, right? So you can pay someone to paint your fence. That doesn't mean you own his painting. It means you own the fence, right? You already owned it, and you own the paint he puts on it. You don't own the act of painting.
Yeah, well, I kind of
he does to get the money.
Yeah, I mean, that example, I kind of think the difference between a product and a service, maybe, and that might just be a very simplistic viewpoint of it. But coming back to the sort of the Lockean theory that you were discussing, you know, this idea that, you know, you own yourself, you own your, you know, your time, your energy, and you sort of mix that labor with something. I mean, I've actually, again, not having had as much, you know, time to study and think about this as you have, but like I've generally aligned with that idea, because I've always thought that, you know, that effort, that energy you put into something, you know, has come from you, and then, you know, you sort of mix your stuff. But I've always had a problem with then the idea of, like, I've got a quote which is, ownership is that which you can protect. So in some ways, I don't know how that fits in with what you kind of said is about, you know, taking something that was traditionally in the public sphere and kind of like segregating.
This is a subtle area of political economy, really, that it's not that hard, but you have to think carefully about it. I used to talk in those terms too, and it's fine if you talk loosely and realize you're talking loosely, like in metaphorical terms, but it can lead to confusion and equivocation, because these terms start having different meanings. So for example, in the Bitcoin space, people say, I own a Bitcoin. What they really mean is they control it, or they possess it. They have the ability to send it to someone. But they use the word ownership because in the field of law, when you own a physical resource, that implies that you have the ability to use it, but it's not the same thing. So in law and in life, we have to distinguish between the descriptive world and the prescriptive world, or you have to distinguish between the economic world and the juristic or legal world. We have to distinguish between is and ought, right? So when you have an economic analysis, it can apply even to one guy, which we call Crusoe, Crusoe alone on his island. So Crusoe alone on his island has to employ means to achieve ends. He has to act. He has to use physical resources, which means he possesses or controls them. He doesn't own them because ownership means the legal right to possess. So ownership is just the ability to control. I'm sorry, possession is the ability to control. Ownership is the legally recognized right to control. And they are different. When you have society arise, and you have other people you're dealing with, that is useful because we have division of labor, we have cooperation, we have society, we can take comfort in the company of other people. So there are benefits to it. But the danger of it is that now you have other human actors who might all want to use, or multiple humans might want to use the same scarce resource at the same time. So there could be conflict now. So now I could previously use this object that I found on my island to do something. But now when there's many people, more than one person might want to use that thing. And that leads to conflict and violence and fighting, which is inefficient and creates strife and prevents you from using the thing peacefully and having long-range plans about it because you're not sure if you'll be able to use it. So in society, we come up with laws, and the laws assign property rights. And they say, okay, for the types of things that people can fight over, have a conflict over, which is scarce resources, we need to have a rule that says who gets to own that thing, like who has the right to control it. And we use the Lockean rules to answer that question. So who gets to use this thing? Well, it's the person who found it first and started using it first when it was unowned. Because if it was unowned, when you start using it, you have a better claim than anyone else because you weren't taking it from someone else who had it first, right? And once you have it, now you have an earlier claim than someone who comes later. And if they were to have a better claim than you, that means there's no such thing as ownership. There's only possession, you see. So once you think of the idea of ownership as having to exist to be distinct from possession, the first guy using it has to have a better claim than later people.
Okay, so just quickly, that the difference there then between ownership and possession.
One is control, one's the right to control. So okay. For example, if I loan you my car, I still own the car, but you're the one possessing it because I gave you the right to use it. So you have the actual control of it. Or if I steal your gun, now I'm possessing it, but you're the owner. You have the right to possess it, which means you have the right to go to the legal system and get the gun back.
So ownership is who had it first or who possessed it first? Would that be a good way to put
ownership,
it?
Ownership is the person who got it first or the person who acquired it from that person by contract. So there's two ways to get ownership of something: by contract, or by first possession, basically, which we call homesteading or original appropriation. So okay, either you so first, you're the first cool. one to get it. Mm-hmm. So like if I'm the first one who gets it, I have a better claim than anyone in the world because I'm the first one. Except if I sold it to someone, now that guy has a better claim against anyone in the world because he has it earlier than all of them. Now I had it earlier than him, but I gave it to him by contract. So now my claim is gone. So those are the only two ways to get property.
Okay,
it's by
cool.
Contract
so then,
or by first use.
Perfect. So that was the piece that I wanted to clarify there. So ownership emerges from first possession and then continues through contractual transactions or contractual.
When you said earlier that ownership is what you can defend. I think you said something like that, which is a common thing. In a sense, that's true, but that's sort of a blending of the two functions of ownership. So ownership emerges because of conflict, right, in society. Because there's conflict, and for those people that want to live in a peaceful way, they prefer to have rules that assign ownership so they can live in peace with each other. And, you know, now I know what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. And if I need to use the thing that's yours, now I have to go to you and make a bargain with you, right? And cooperate with you. So that's the system most civilized people prefer. As a matter of fact, over time, if you're not able to defend your rights, then they will be lost just as a practical matter, right? Like by conquest or just by time. So there is a practical aspect to ownership. Like it's not a self-enforcing thing. God's not up there making sure the contracts and property rights are respected. It depends upon a consensus in the community and an effective legal mechanism for them to actually work. Otherwise, it's useless, and we do have a war of all against all, and we're back to savagery, right? And we're back to the pre-civilized, pre-societies state of affairs, like an animal type life. But so long as we're in society, we have a body of norms that say you should have the right to control this thing, and if someone takes it from you, you try to get it back, either with your self-help or with the help of your neighbors, basically through institutions.
So coming then from someone who might say, two questions here is, how does one establish the original possession? Like, how can someone establish a claim and say, look, no one else owned this, you know, I owned it first. Like, how does one establish that, A? And B, the next question that I'll follow up with is going to be, how do we enforce this idea of property rights or ownership in the absence of some form of monopoly on enforcement?
Okay, so those are two questions. So so I think of property rights and contract law. Contract law is derivative of property rights, but let's talk about contract first. So imagine you own a car and you want to give it or sell it to me. How do you do that? You have to communicate your intention to give it to me somehow. So in a sense, contractual transfer is a matter of communication, which is a matter of language. So the question really is a question about language. So the question would be like saying, how do we communicate things to people? There's lots of ways we communicate things to other people. We can speak, we can write, or you can do things that signify things, right? In a community where people know what actions mean. You know, if I raise my fist at you, that might be interpreted as I'm about to hit you, right? Or if I look at you with a bad look, that might mean displeasure, right? So, or if I live in a neighborhood where it's the custom in the area for people to walk up to their neighbor's doors and knock on the door to ask for a favor, like I need to borrow a cup of sugar, then by living in that neighborhood and by not putting up a post-it sign saying, I'm opting out of this default understanding that people are entitled to walk on my property, knock on my door, and ask me for an innocuous favor, I'm opting out of that rule. If I don't do that, then I'm effectively communicating, okay, I'm going along with the majority opinion, the majority custom in this area, which is you have my permission or license to use my property in this minor way, right? So it doesn't always, so that's implicit, right? It doesn't always have to be explicit and written down in a written contract or even spoken language. In fact, two people that don't speak the same language can exchange, right? By signs. I can hand you an apple, you hand me your banana, we both walk away happy. We know what we meant. So this is really a question of language. And it's not, it's interesting, and there's a whole science about that, but it's not that complicated. But it's a practical question about what people meant. So when we come back to property, it's similar to contract. So if I own a contract, if I own a resource and I want to give it to you, I have to indicate my assent to that or my consent by some expression. I can hand it to you. I can go along with the default customs in the area, let those make the assumption be brought to life. I can say something. I can write it down. Something. But there needs to be some objective indication that my intention was to give it to you and that you wanted to intend to receive it. Now, when you come to owning property, so Hans Hermann Hoppe, who is a student of Rothbard, so he basically builds on Mises and Rothbard, and that's my background. I think those are the three key thinkers that for political philosophy. Mises on economics and a little bit on politics, Rothbard on both, and Hoppe on all three. So he took the radicalism of Rothbard, and he was even more Misesian than Rothbard, so he kind of combined the three. And I build on those. I mean, so that's what my lineage is those guys. So Hoppe thinks of homesteading, which is the Lockean idea that you mix your labor with something, is basically, he calls it embroidering. And if you think about it, like the word private property, I've always thought, or I've long thought that is a misnomer, because in a sense, public property is a better term, because property can't be private. It's public in the sense that there have to be publicly visible borders, because the whole function of property is to have a rule that says who owns what. So that rule has to identify what the borders of the property are, and there has to be some objective, visible public link between that resource and some actor, so you know who the owner is, right? So the way you do that is you stamp, as Locke would say, you stamp your personality on it by mixing your labor in it, which is metaphorical. Hoppe would say you embroider it. So in the simple case, you put a fence up around it. Like you, if you want to, you see an empty plot of land and you want to build the farm on it, you put a fence up, you build some crops, you build a log cabin. Now you have a farm. So now there's objective signs to the world that this is no longer unowned. It is owned by someone. So it's been transformed, but more importantly, it's been transformed in a way that puts up borders or boundaries. And public evidence can reveal who that person is. So it's either the person who did it, who people in the community know, or it's the person he sold it to. So when you sell it, that act of sale is also a public record that people can investigate because you communicated it and there's some record of that communication. See, so it all ties in together beautifully. So it's really a matter of communication. So when you come to own a resource, you have to do it in a way that's practically and pragmatically sufficient to serve as a warning to other people. You know, if you just walk across the virgin forest and then later you claim you owned it, it's like you didn't transform it at all. You didn't set up borders. You did something that multiple people could do, which is why Hoppe says you can't own something by mere verbal decree. This is why, like, the kings in Europe couldn't just say, I declare that the entire North American continent of wilderness, you know, really kind of half owned by the Native Americans, but is unowned, and I own it by decree. So I'm giving a patent. That's where patents come from, by the way. A patent, which is an open letter to some guy to go and claim it for me. So he steps foot on North America, he claims the entire territory for the king, even though he hasn't transformed it or put up borders or anything. That's wrong. And the reason that's wrong is because if you have the rule that property or resources can be owned by verbal decree, then a million people could do that at the same time. So it wouldn't solve conflict. The whole purpose of property rights is to solve conflict. But if you come up with a rule that creates conflict, that's contrary to the whole nature of property rights. So it has to be a type of action that there cannot be conflict over. And that means the first person who gets there, there can only be one first person. So there can't be conflict over first claims because only one person gets to it first. But you have to do it in a way that leaves a trace of your connection to it, a link. Hoppe calls it a link. Anyway, that's a compressed version of the theory that I think is the most commonsensical, clear, non-metaphorical way of explaining the core of all private Western law, Roman law, civil law, law merchant, even Roman canon law, even church canon law, and the common law of the West. And all legal systems, in a sense, have to be built upon that. And they're just not consistent. It's just like your regular person is soft libertarian, but they're not consistent. These legal systems aren't consistent either because people weren't thinking about this fundamental deductive principled approach to it. They were doing something pragmatic to solve problems. And because the world is an orderly, rational world, the solution they came up with tends to converge upon what we would deduce from our armchairs. You know, just like many guys seeing an elephant, feeling different parts of it or feeling the same thing. It's no surprise that the deductive or principled approach to things converges on the pragmatic or consequentialist approach. So I've never been one that thought that practicality, and even Ayn Rand said this, she said the moral is the practical, right? There's no, you don't have to choose, are you a consequentialist or are you a deontological, they call it, a principled libertarian. I mean, if you're forced to choose, you have to choose your principles, really. But in the long run, there's no divergence. Now, utilitarianism is what I think of as a subset of consequentialism. So consequentialism is perfectly fine because the principles that we come up with are principles we come up with in the real world of conflict to solve problems. So the point of these principles is to have good consequences or outcomes for humanity. Consequentialism, broadly speaking, is fine. But the way to achieve consequentialism is to have principles, right? But utilitarianism as a subset of consequentialism is problematic for methodological reasons because number one, value is subjective and it's not cardinal. It's not a number. There's no numbers approach to value. And it's not interpersonally comparable. And I would argue it's not even comparable for the same person across time. Like, I don't value this pipe right now the same as I valued it 10 minutes ago. They're just different things in time. And furthermore, ethically speaking, even if you could show that someone values one thing more than someone else in cardinal terms, still doesn't mean you have the right to get, like, you could say that Bill Gates has billions of dollars and values that billionth dollar less than a poor person would. I don't even think that's necessarily true. And it's incoherent for economic reasons, right? Because you can't compare these things. But even if it was true, it still doesn't mean that it's ethically okay to take Bill Gates's dollar and give it to someone else, because it's theft. It violates the principle that people should have what they own. So there's so many problems with utilitarianism as a subset of consequentialism. So I don't want to see, I don't want to be endorsing utilitarianism by saying consequentialism is fine. The problem is sometimes people use the word utilitarianism as a synonym for consequentialism. But if they're being strictly technically correct, I would oppose utilitarianism, which, by the way, is where Ayn Rand got confused in her critique. So she liked Mises, but she criticized him as being a subjectivist. But she, by subjectivist, she meant relativism, moral relativism. Whereas by subjectivism, Mises meant that value is in the eye of the beholder, like you act to gain. Which Ayn Rand actually believed, because she said value is something you act to gain and or keep. So this is the importance, this shows the importance of keeping terms clearly defined and straight. And if they have ambiguous or dual meanings, you have to keep that in mind and be careful not to slip into unintentional equivocation, or even worse, intentional equivocation, which a lot of people do. Like Menarchus, when they argue for the state, they'll equivocate on the word government. Like they'll try to trap you by saying, you believe in law and order, don't you? Yes. Well, then you believe in government. So how can you oppose the state? It's like, well, so they first equate government to law and order, and then they equate it to the state. And that's because they're statists and they believe that order can only come from the state, but they're still using the word in two different senses. But because we disagree with them on political theory, we think the state and law and order are different things, and that law and order can be achieved apart from the state, and in fact cannot be achieved by the state, because the state undermines law and order. Anyway,
no, that was a really good set. So I want to mention the utilitarian thing that I wholeheartedly agree with. That actually Jimmy and I were discussing that, and we had a conversation about how does morality emerge in the absence of something like religion? And he thought I was making a utilitarian argument for it, but my argument was not utilitarian. And I think you kind of described why just then. Is my argument was one of the consistency of principles, and principles are things that emerge over time, that are broadly consistent with the flow of sort of existence and the flow of life. And sort of my interpretation of what I've, understood over, my study across different subjects. So it's by no means as deep as, what you just discussed then.
Let me ask you a question. So I think Jimmy, who I like a lot, I'm respecting him more and more, because I've talked to him. I at first I thought he was just like a latecomer to libertarianism. Like, he just happened to start learning a little bit about it because he was surrounded by a bunch of libertarians. Like, I thought he was a Bitcoiner first, but now I'm realizing he's pretty deep into Austrian economics and libertarian theory. But I think he comes at it from a Christian point of view, or that's part of his thing, right? Are you Christian yourself?
No.
Okay.
No.
So that's why there's an interesting, another thing that's probably too hard to get into here, but there's another interesting connection between legal positivism and logical positivism and all the stuff we've been talking about. I think there's a connect. Logical positivism is the scientific idea that the only scientific or true statements are those that are empirically testable, right? Which is just, it's contradictory on its face, because that statement itself is not testable, but you think it's true. So empiricism has to be built upon an a priori base, in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. So they both have to have validity. And And legal positivism is the idea that rules can only come from a sovereign, like be announced or decreed. Now, those of us who believe in anarchy and libertarians think there's a standard of morality or political norms outside of some government authority or state authority. And as an atheist, I even think that's true of ethics and God, because when we say God is good, he's not the definition of good. He's not the source of good. He is good because he happens to conform to this outside notion of good, right? I know this is a hot a theological debate, and the religionists will quibble or whatever. But in a sense, so the religionists, especially the Catholics, have more of a natural law type Thomistic view, which is more compatible in form to our libertarian views, right? Like Rothbard was a natural law kind of guy, natural rights kind of guy. But in a sense, the religionists are still logical positivists, or sorry, legal positivists, because ultimately they believe God decrees what's right and wrong. So most statists believe that the legislature or the state can decree what's right and wrong. And the religious libertarians, to their credit, reject that. But they push it back one level. God can decree what's right.
Yeah.
However, however, God is supposed to be infallible and all good. So at least his
rules he's are got a be better correct, claim to that.
Which means libertarian. Yeah. So, but the state is corrupt. God's not corrupt. So if we're gonna have someone decree the rules, at least it would be God, not the state. Okay. I give him credit for that, but
yeah, that's I think I can't remember if this came from a podcast I was doing or something, but it's sort of the idea that and then this kind of aligns with what you mentioned about positivism, is, you know, that there's principles sort of emerge, and I'm a big believer of sort of the bottom-up theory of existence and life, is, you know, things sort of emerge over time, and, you know, the more consistent they are and the more in line with you know, reality they are, the longer they exist, and, you know, the more so. I kind of view principles as sort of almost like a, kind of like a groove in the fabric of existence. It's something that, you know, it's always there, and things will sort of flow along those principled lines, and, you know, we'll always have idiots come up with, you know, different types of methodologies and, you know, positivist viewpoints on things which don't sort of align with those grooves. You know, they sort of run against the grain, but, you know, the flow of life ends up kind of, you know, making those things obsolete. And I actually don't think that requires the decree of a God. I think that is stuff that emerges. You muted yourself.
Here's one way I think about it. The reason to live by principle, it's sort of like a convergence of reasons, which is, again, like the reason consequentialism and principle thinking and deontological thinking, a priori thinking, converge on each other. Number one is like conceptual efficiency. I mean, the reason we have concepts instead of just living by instinct and by pure data perceptions, by percepts, is we have high level concepts to understand the world, right? And we're above the animal, the mere animals, but who have to live by instinct. So rising above instinct allows us to do greater things, right? But you have to know what to do in an unexpected situation, right? Which is why prejudice is useful. I mean, prejudice just means prejudging a situation, because you don't have time to investigate everything. So if you see something that looks suspicious, you know, sort of like an instinctual conceptual thing, you have a default assumption and you have to act on it. Otherwise, your whole life is a series of ad hoc decisions, and you don't have time to research them all. And if it's just ad hoc, it might as well be random, right? So we have principles because you need, and then also because we live in society, your reputation matters, and your reputation reflects your character. People need to know what your character is, because that's how they assess what your human action structure is. Like they classify you as a threat or as a friend. Someone useful to trade with, someone that's a possible enemy. So they look at your character, and your character's revealed in your actions. You have a reputation. So if you have a reputation for honesty, for example, people are more likely to trade with you. You're going to succeed you're going to prosper, they're going to prosper. So how do you have a reputation for being honest? The best way is to be honest. But to be honest, you have to have a principle that says, I'm going to be honest in every situation, even if I can't see exactly why in this case, like even if I think I could get away with it in this case. Because if you take the stance, I'm going to tell the truth, except when I can get away with it, because we're holistic people and we're not actors, you can't be a complete, I mean, we have a psychology. If you live your life as a fraud, eventually people notice because they get good at noticing that because it's to their advantage to be able to notice that because they need to know the character of people they're dealing with, right? Whether they're going to be ripped off or stabbed in the back. So it's useful to live by principles because that reveals your character as someone who lives by principles to people. So there's all kinds of reasons to live by principle. And then the question is, what are those principles? And in the micro case, you could, and another thing is you'll have people that disagree with us. They will come up with these ad hoc examples like, well, what about two guys on a lifeboat and only one can live? What do your libertarian rules say about that? And my response is always, well, what are your socialist rules say about that? I mean, if you're coming up with a situation where someone's got to die, this is just not a situation where everyone can live in peace and prosperity and harmony together. So tragedy is possible in the world. How does having socialism prevent tragedy? I mean, it's just a stupid. So you're criticizing our theory for not being God, basically, and preventing every possible tragedy. And even God doesn't do that, right? God lets bad things happen too. So, I mean, you're criticizing us for doing something your theory doesn't stop either. So, okay, so libertarianism doesn't solve every lifeboat scenario. Yeah, because there's no solution to those situations. You know, how about let's talk about real life where we sometimes can live in peace and prosperity with each other. So then the question is, what's the principle?
I always love those examples, the amount of stupid examples people have asked me. It's like, so what if you and Godzilla were in a car and you're driving at, yeah, it's like, where the fuck did you even come up with this example? And how is it even possible to answer that? It's like, what do you think I am? Oh man.
Yeah.
It's okay. So then let's move into then our second question. So someone asks, okay. So your explanation then is about the first question about how do we prove first possession is, you know, that you can't just sort of claim it with words. There needs to be some sort of, deductive, or there needs to be some sort of linkage all the way back.
An objective, Hoppe calls it intersubjectively ascertainable. That's more of a Kantian phrase, and a synonym for that is objective. It's some objective, publicly visible link, right?
Okay.
Which usually involves transformation.
Mm-hmm. And in the absence of that, you basically just a LARPer, basically someone who just says that you own it, but in reality, you have no way to prove
you're
it.
A LARPer. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So, Mr. Status over here then asks, well, how the fuck do you enforce that? And who has the right to enforce that? And how does that function in the absence of some form of authority?
I would first say, well, what makes you think the authority is going to enforce it? I mean, this governmental authority, governments routinely invade rights. And ultimately this question is the Randian, the critique of the Randians, who the ultimate logic of their view that you can't have private or competing, say, justice or defense agencies because they would have war against each other. Well, the logic of that is that you have to have a one world government. You can only have one government, right? But they never favor that because they say, well, ideally that is what we want. They admit that. But they say, but right now that would result in more socialism because like the West is quasi-libertarian, but the rest of the world is even more socialist. So if you combine the whole world into a mass democracy, then we've lost, right? Well, but that's the case even within a large country, you know, the US. I mean, why not have smaller and smaller, smaller units? There's no limit to the units. So I would say, first of all, the government doesn't protect rights. It undermines rights. All you can hope for is that when you have norms, they emerge because there's a sufficient consensus in society. People, by and large, most people are decent people and they want to live in peace with each other. And so they will the only solution is for them all to agree that we have to use our reason to come up with a reasonable set of rules. And as I just explained, the only rules that are reasonable is first use and contract. Because if first use is not your primary rule, then no one could ever use anything, because you have these unknown things out there and no one would ever use it. We'd all just die. So you have to let people use things the first time for them to ever be used. Well, if someone uses it the first time, either they have ownership of it or they don't. If they do, then that's the main principle. If they don't, then we don't have ownership, because that means that a second person who comes later has a better right or as much right to take it as the first person, which means we don't have ownership. We just have possession. We're back to the state of nature, war all against all. So, and this is what Hoppe calls the latecomer principle, right? A latecomer has to have a worse claim than an earlier user, a prior user. And it's like the regression theorem of Mises and money. He traces the current purchasing power of money, like gold, back to an initial day when it didn't have a monetary value. It was just a bartered commodity, right? That's a regression theorem. So the same type of logic can be used. If you have this idea of ownership itself, right? Ownership itself implies the first use principle, because ownership means that ownership is distinct from possession, which means that someone who has the right to own it owns it even if he doesn't possess it, right? But that implies that whoever owns it even if someone takes it from them. And that's a latecomer. So that means that a current user has a better claim than a latecomer, the second guy who takes it from him, right? That's what ownership means, is that I own it even when someone takes it from me. So the very notion of ownership, the very idea, implies that an earlier claimant has a better claim than somebody takes it from him later. So if you go back and regress that, like the regression theorem, you get to a point where the first guy took it from the state of ownership, state of wilderness, the state of the commons in the world. And when he took it, he didn't violate anyone's rights because no one had it by definition. Mm-hmm. So that first act is a pristine act that can't be challenged. And he has a better claim than anyone who comes later because of the latecomer principle, because of the ownership principle. That's why the first use principle has to be the principle reasonable people would agree on for us to live. So we have to assume we have a community of people that are relatively benevolent, want to live in peace and prosperity with each other, and they would all, using their reason, come to agree on this general abstract principle. And then over time, that principle would be applied in concrete disputes and situations by courts and tribunals, and a body of law would gradually emerge that would refine and refine and refine this. You have more and more concrete legal principles that apply to principles, to situations. Like in the beginning, everything is sort of like, we know the general principle, but we have to apply it. So there's some uncertainty, but it's better than nothing. But over time, the body of law develops, and then you know exactly what the rules are. How long you can leave your property untended before people are going to assume that you abandoned it. You know, if you're gone for 30 years, weeds are growing up, no one knows where you are, and people start using it and you don't stop them, eventually they're going to take it by acquisitive prescription, mm-hmm. or by statute of limitations. So these rules will start developing, and then you know what they are. Or like the rule I mentioned earlier, you know, if you live in a regular neighborhood where the custom is for people to be able to walk across their lawns to retrieve an errant softball or football or baseball, or to knock on their door for a cup of sugar, then that rule has been established and people know what it is. Now, you can always opt out of it with an act of communication, but you know what it is. So that helps increase the certainty in society, legal certainty, which promotes economic growth, because now you can do better plans and have more long-term planning and things like that. So it all kind of converges on each other. Now, the concrete answer is, I think people would have insurance. Now, I'm not an expert on this. This is what Hoppe and Bob Murphy and David Friedman and others have written on, the Tannehills. The prediction is that you would have insurance companies. People would tend to have insurance to insure themselves from liability and from acts of theft from outlaws and criminals. And the insurance company would then have an incentive to reduce the amount of theft so that they don't have to pay out as many claims, and that they would hire and work out arrangements to have security and police and defense and to crime prevention, right? So it would be a natural thing. And then if there's a dispute, they would have agreements with each other, just like countries now have treaties with each other to extradite criminals or to respect each other's judgments in their own courts. You would have agreements because it's the customers of these agencies would prefer that their agencies work out peaceful agreements with other agencies rather than going to war with each other, because war is expensive and my premiums are going to be higher, right? So there's always an economic incentive for peace and for cooperation and compromise over fights and battles. Ultimately, the main uses of force would be self-defense against the staunch minority of people that are outlaws and criminals, and the force we authorize to recover our property when it's stolen and to get restitution when someone commits a really bad crime.
So, okay, so a couple of questions there that I want to pull on threads. So these rules that you sort of mentioned, these rules and norms within a community, could one argue that they're sort of like a quasi-constitution in a sense? Because I guess my question that follows on from that is like...
You can call them that, sure.
Okay. So how do these rules then scale across larger and larger populations? So in my, like, I don't believe that norms and rules and customs actually can scale very well, and hence why I'm a bit more of a localist than anything else. You know, I think the more fragmented and more local we are. So would you agree with that? Or could you sort of talk me through how...
Yeah.
You know.
Although I would have an aversion to the word constitution, because... it literally means to make, right, to constitute. And the purpose of the Constitution, like in the US, was to constitute a new government. So it was really, people think of it as the protection of rights or the framework of law, but they think of it that way because that's the propaganda that was used to sell it. So it was really, the purpose of it was to create a new central state. But because of fears that it would violate rights and become too powerful, they tried to put limits in there to limit what this new state would do. And then they characterize that as, well, look, it protects our rights, which means we're creating a dangerous new beast, but we're putting some shackles on him. Well, the purpose of it wasn't to protect rights. It was to create a new government. Now, they did believe that they were creating this new powerful beast as a guardian to protect our rights, but that's not how it works out. It's really a dangerous beast that has its own interests, and it protects us only enough to get our consent to keep taking taxes from us. But it's basically keeping the slaves from having an uprising, right? That's all it does. Yeah. So I would use a different term, but people think of it as a framework. I think the current international model is a good model to think of for the way free society would work. So right now you have roughly 200 sovereign nation states or countries, and they all have a baseline of abstract principles that they agree to, which is international law. Like sovereignty is one, everyone should be left alone. And pacta sunt servanda is the international principle that agreements are to be respected, which means treaties. Treaties have a binding effect, which means contracts. So basically it's leave me alone because I had this country first. So it's kind of like an analog of the Lockean first homesteading principle, and respect contracts, which is what I said are the two basic rules of all private law, is first ownership and contract. And so it works to a rough degree. Countries are independent. They trade with each other. They're citizens. Now it works on a massive scale, but there's no reason they couldn't be smaller. You could imagine 2,000 city states or 10,000 city states in the world instead of one. So I do believe, and by the way, if you want to read more on this, or your listeners do, a good source on this would be Randy Barnett's book, The Structure of Liberty. Part of that book I've criticized for being too Hayekian, but a lot of it is great. It's anarchist theory, and he imagines like the legal system and an interplay of what he calls a polycentric world, which means kind of what you're talking about, localism. So you have abstract legal principles, and then they get more and more concrete. But the abstract principles are the ones that can be shared globally, right? Like basically the general statement, like first ownership, or first use ownership, and then contract, right? And then different regions are going to develop their own concrete legal rules according to the customs, the values of the people, their history, and they might be different from region to region, but there's no problem with that. Just like there's no problem now with, you know, France might have a certain law on how you solemnize a will, and England might have a different set of rules on how a will is solemnized. But that's okay to have different rules because they generally apply only within that jurisdiction or that region, right? So there's no conflict between these regions because what they do, sort of like what people do in the privacy of their own bedrooms, is their business. Like whatever sexuality or whatever I want to have doesn't affect you because it's in the walls of my own bedroom. So likewise, I think that the internal concrete rules that would develop on a micro level in different regions would tend to be different. Now, I think they would also have some common features, you know, but they might have different language. They might have different details. You know, the age of consent might be 16 in one country and 18 in another and 15 in another, but the basic ideas would still be there. Just the details would vary, but those details usually wouldn't be in conflict with each other because they're enforced only within a certain territory. And then you can just take that to a micro, more and more micro levels down to the individual, which, or the family unit at least, which would be basically anarcho-capitalist.
Okay, so a couple things I want to pull on there. Maybe before I ask about how the size of these sort of smaller regions, I wanted to ask how do we synchronize or make consistent you know, those sort of larger scale ideas that you said, so sort of the ownership by first possession and contract is sort of like the overarching thing. How do we sync that up with societies, I guess, or regions which have emerged slightly differently? Like I mean, for example, the Confucian East, you know, like the idea of you know, I guess, you know, China and Japan and India and like some of those places emerge with a different set of values that may be inconsistent with these sort of first principles ideas. So how do we navigate that?
I mean, in a way, one analogy could be the Bitcoin network. Like you have the high powered base currency, and then you have layers, mm-hmm. right? You have different layers. So you can think of it almost like that, like the base layer is just the general abstract rules. So if there's a conflict between regions, either it's on the abstract rules that apply between these regions, or it's just internally. If it's internally, I don't see there being a conflict. It's just that region has a different set of internal rules. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the more, if you have 10,000 city states, the more of these you have, then the more option for exit there is. So people in there, yes. If they don't like it, they can just leave. And that will put a big break on how egregiously bad these little regions can be, because they just won't be able to keep their citizens if it's too bad. And then a second thing would be the evolutionary thing. I would say that there can be reasonable variation in how these rules are implemented. But if they deviate too far or in an unreasonable way or in an illiberal way, then because these rules are not compatible with natural law and with the way humans trade, these regions are going to be poorer. They're not going to prosper. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and so mm-hmm. over time, they're going to be just overwhelmed by the other regions that are all relatively more liberal, and that they grow stronger. Paradoxically, see, Hoppe points out that in today's world with democracy, you have this paradoxical thing where the countries that are relatively more liberal with their internal policies, like the United States, they tend to be more bellicose internationally. So that's because if you have a freer market internally, you're going to be richer. But when you're richer, the state is richer because it's taxing us. And when the state's richer, it follows its own internal logic with respect to other states and uses that power to conquer other states or to boss them around or to expand its territory. So paradoxically, the Soviet Union was horrible internally, but that made them poor, so they could only afford to do so much internationally. Whereas the U.S., but that logic disappears when you have small city states, because they could never have that much power to conquer 9,900 other countries, and their citizens would just leave if their taxes are being wasted on these bullshit, you know, interventions. Right now, with democracy, it does create some countries win out by natural selection. The ones that happen to adopt free market policies are going to get bigger and richer, but then they're going to tend to ruin it by using it for interventionism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But hopefully that tendency would that paradox would diminish with smaller and smaller states and that are more capitalist and smaller.
Yeah, well, this is, I guess, what you just described there is the natural or probably instinctual conclusion that Bitcoin has come up with, and why the whole Bitcoin fixes this meme exists, is I actually think the only way for large scale nation states to exist is through the monopoly on the creation of money. Like they cannot do it in any other way. So you break that, you actually make it economically infeasible to grow the Leviathan any larger than, you know, some sort of manageable.
What they can tax, basically. Yeah. Yeah. I used to think that Bitcoiners are a little bit nuts and utopians, but I'm starting to believe more and more when you say Bitcoin. I mean, I'm in Texas. I'm in Houston. I was without power and water for several days in freezing cold weather a couple of weeks ago because the windmills broke down. Right. If we had more windmills, then we could have just, you know, even if a third of them broke, it would have been fine. We don't have more windmills. Why not? Because it's not feasible to build windmills that you don't use at peak all the time. But if you have mining farms using the power, you could build excess capacity. And then when there's an emergency, they can just stop mining and sell the electricity, you know, so it's going to help fix the energy problem. And I think I agree. The more you think about it, states can only tax so much. Tax rates have been, like in the West, have been pretty constant for the last 50 years, like, you know, 20 something percent is all they can tax. It's hard to get away with more taxes. So they spend more than they tax because they can sell treasuries, right? They can sell debt. But
they can borrow from the future. Exactly. Yeah. They can do all this.
Bitcoin's going to remove that ability. I think Bitcoin's going to remove the ability of nation states to operate at a deficit, which means they won't be able to spend all this money on wars and interventionism. So they're going to have to do only what they can tax people. And if they try to tax them too much, it's not going to work. They're going to become banana republics.
Correct. And I think by virtue of that, that's where they start to actually break down, because then what you have is you don't have the existence of a nanny state or the existence of a central bank or the existence of something that can potentially bail you out. Like all of that starts to break down and you actually do get separation, you get fragmentation, you get localism, and you get sort of a movement back to what I think is the actual, you know, the realistic nature of existence amongst human beings, which doesn't scale very well. Like, you know, different people want to live differently, you know, notwithstanding those sort of core principles that I think, you know, you elucidated earlier, which are absolutely important. But other than that, like, you know, even like, you know, I'm writing a piece now talking about how the technocratic Leviathan has emerged. So like, you know, people are talking about how Google and Amazon and everything like that are becoming, you know, more important and more powerful than nation states. The only reason they've been able to emerge is because the monopoly on money, the state existed. Yep. And the state has kind of signed this Faustian bargain where they've deformed society to such an extent that these technocratic elites have managed to emerge abhorrently. Like I don't believe monopolies can actually exist in a competitive world, like, because you become larger and larger, you not only get attacked more, but you can't move as efficiently. So, you know, naturally speaking, competitors come in and they, you know, they take your territory. And, you know, the dynamic nature of existence also means that what you might have been doing today is not the same as, you know, what's valuable in 5 or 10 years from now. So monopolies can't last unless a monopoly like the state exists in the first place, in which case you get close to that, and then, you know, you create your own version of a fucking monopoly.
Yeah, so again, Bitcoin fixes and also, you know, at the same time that the state, as Bitcoin starts to erode their ability to spend money that they can't tax, they don't have, and they're less, at the same time that the state is less able to support a welfare state, at the same time, people are getting richer, so they don't need it as much either, right? So people can save more and their savings grow, and they don't need the state to be their nanny state to take care of them in retirement. They can take care of their own retirement. So all these things will complement each other, I believe. And as for money, you know, like as a libertarian, as an anarchist, you can identify all the horrible things the state does, the legal systems, the laws that we have. You know, the drug war is horrible, taxation is horrible, central banking is horrible, government schools are horrible, intellectual property is horrible. I think sometimes you could argue that intellectual property is the worst But I've kind of come to believe that the two worst things are intellectual property and central banking, because central banking really is what supports the state. And the state's corruption of money really has, we can't even imagine all the horrible ways it's permeated and pervaded society. It's changed the character of people. It's changed our habits. It's changed how we go into debt. We buy a house with a mortgage. You know, people invest in the stock market and don't know anything about it because they have to, because the dollars erode over time. All these things that we do now are going to change radically, and it's going to improve social, human culture and habits and character for the better. I think we're going to be better savers. We're going to not be as much debtors. We're going to have a higher, a lower time preference. You know, the government, you know, people will be more individually responsible. Everything is going to get better, I think, with Bitcoin, and it's going to limit the state. And hopefully we'll have a soft landing, a soft transition, rather than Mad Max world, you know.
Yeah, hopefully. I wrote a piece last year called Utopian Dystopias, and sort of like the, and it was kind of a, like me from my position kind of bashing utilitarianism and bashing, you know, what all these people think that, you know, somehow some person's vision of what is right is, you know, I always say it's like the it's the classic, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, is, you know, someone's utopia is another person's dystopia. And like, you know, Bitcoin sort of, you know, demolishes all of those fantasies. But the in there, I say that fragmentation, or the sort of the breakdown of these monolithic societies is going to happen whether we like it or not. So that it's not a question of if, it's a question of how. Is, do we get there more consciously through, like what you said, like a softer kind of landing, or does this clusterfuck of a monolith collapse in on itself because the parasite just got too big and the whole thing broke? And that's really the only question.
And the US is the one I worry about the most, because the US government is the most powerful, and it has the dollar hegemony over the world right now. So it's the one that really stands to lose the most when the dollar stops being the world reserve currency. But because the US is sort of a leader in the Bitcoin space, maybe it'll be impossible for them to stop it too. And so they'll have to let it peacefully start co-opting what they're doing. And they'll have to bend to reality. When they can't spend as much, they'll have to figure out a way not to spend as much. I mean,
the game theory would be really interesting. So I got a couple more questions. I know you've got to run soon. How much time do you roughly have?
Say 7 more minutes.
Seven.
If you if you want, we can do a part two later and just avoid all the introductory stuff and just do questions.
I think it might be worth doing. But I guess in the 7 minutes that we have, let's talk through. I think we'll have to come back to the IP question, because I want to talk about sort of, you know, the plight of the inventor and all this sort of shit. But let's just ask one question here: is why do you think it is that a lot of prominent libertarians, like, so we've just sort of discussed Bitcoin, is, you know, and there was obviously this whole row with Eric July recently and all this sort of shit. And it's like, for me, having come to libertarianism, I guess, after Bitcoin, for me, just like libertarianism for me was just so consistent. I was like, holy fuck, it makes so much sense. Why do you think a lot of libertarians just don't get Bitcoin, like, or even, you know, generally end up going down the shitcoin path? Like Roger Ver is a perfect example of someone who's, you know, quite a strong libertarian, but complete fucking moron when it comes to like economic reality.
I think those are two different things. So I thought most libertarians were kind of into Bitcoin, but maybe that's just the ones I see. I guess the ones that are not into it are probably not into it because they're older and they're more used to fighting the battle their way, right? So they fight it with electoral politics and the Libertarian Party, the Ron Paul movement, and also by being gold bugs. And maybe they're a little bit too complacent in their understanding of Austrian economics, and they think the regression theorem means that it has to be a physical commodity. And they may just be too old. Maybe it's just the old generations have to get wiped out and the new ones will learn. So there could be a bit of that hangover effect from just the model they're used to, which is gold. Sound money is gold, and you fight it by, you know, Libertarian Party activism. And then the Roger Ver thing, the shitcoin thing, I think that's partly the same thing. Like, so you had these early libertarians, and by the way, I was never one of these guys. Like, I mean, I've been into it since about 2013, dipping my toe into it. And, you know, I started getting a little bit on occasion. I never knew which one to buy or whether it was going to work. But when I got some, I never spent it. Like, I was annoyed by these libertarians who would say, oh, you need to use it. It's like it's a stunt to them. It's like, you know, like you'd have a vending. I went to Porkfest 2011, 2013. And there was a vending machine in the woods selling Bitcoins, you know, and people would sell the t-shirts. You could use a QR code and use your wallet on your phone to buy a t-shirt with Bitcoins. But it's almost like just a proof, like, oh, it can work. Look, I can do this. It's neat. But it really wasn't convenient. It didn't add anything. You already had dollars in your wallet. Yeah. I mean, it didn't solve a problem. I mean, the problem with dollars is not that you can't buy things with them, right? We have a dollars work fine for medium of exchange right now for payment. I mean, it works. It works for economic calculation. The problem with it is that it's inflated and it loses purchasing power over time. Right, that's the main problem with dollars is that it's inflated, and it's inflated because the government controls it and it's centralized. That's the problem with it. So, I think that these guys thought that Bitcoin was a threat to money by supplanting the payment network of money, and people should start using it like activists. So they're activists. So they wanted to. They were criticizing libertarians for holding their money because you need to spend it. You need to use it. I'm like, why the hell would I use something that's going up in value? It doesn't even make any sense.
I think they've conflated the term use. They think use, so they don't understand that a use is also, you know, storing your wealth. Like that's one of the core functions of money, is the capacity to store the product of your fucking labor. So I think that for me is a completely, you know, those people are moronic. Like they just don't get that Bitcoin's primary use case is the demonopolization of money, and that needs to start with, you know, not replacing PayPal, but replacing the Federal Reserve. That's the key thing there. But coming back to the libertarian stuff, then, so I kind of came up with a theory of like the battered woman syndrome version of libertarians. It's kind of like, you know, libertarians that have gotten used to basically talking about how stupid the state is and all this sort of stuff, but kind of gotten comfortable just complaining about it as opposed to, you know, believing in any solution, or maybe even having become disillusioned with not having a viable solution for the disintegration of the state. Like, would you agree in that sort of, would you agree with that observation, or
probably? And also, I always think that the activist mentality is always impatient. They want results now, and this is one reason why they tend not to be anarchists. They tend to be what I think of as kind of compromising, kind of wishy-washy sellouts, because, you know, they'll compromise with the state, they'll become Republicans or whatever, just to make some little improvement now. God damn it, I want it now. So they're like petulant children stamping their feet. They're too fucking impatient. You know, if you tell them, well, look, we just need to let Bitcoin gradually grow in value, and eventually it will plateau and reach a point where, yeah, you don't need to hold it all the time, but because it's appreciating, then you can, then you might be willing to spend some of it, because you're not missing out on this, the huge growth it's going to have during the adoption phase. But if you tell them, well, that might take 10 or 20 years, you know, they don't want to wait 10 or 20 years. They want it to happen now. But I don't even know what they're, did they really think that people are going to run around buying t-shirts with Bitcoin when money works perfectly fine? And not only that, it's a pain in the ass because, well, the technology is in its infancy, but not only that, there's capital gains tax on every goddamn purchase or sale. I mean, every sale of Bitcoin. Like, if you purchase something, you're selling your Bitcoin. So there's a capital gains that's complicated and it's expensive. So because the government has monopolized money for right now and Bitcoin is not legal tender, it would be stupid to spend it and to use it in a purchase, because then I got to keep track of that little $2 purchase or that $20 purchase and tell my tax accountants at the end of the year to figure out the taxes on it. It's just like, it's just not feasible. From what I can tell, it's not feasible. It never was feasible. And it never was feasible for it to ever scale up and become money. It worked at first because it was cheap, because it was not being used. But the blockchain is a horrible database. It's inefficient, it's slow by design. It can never be used to track all payments, as far as I understand it. I'm not a technical expert. Yep. So it could never be used that way. It's not designed to be used that way. So give up on this pipe dream of using it for daily payments to replace the dollar. So I guess I've bought the maxi arguments to some degree.
Yep. Yeah, 100%, 100%. I think you've articulated that well. And I think, I guess, even beyond that is like, I said it earlier, is Bitcoin's mission is first and foremost to supplant the existing state-owned monopolies on money. You know, if we can achieve that, that's the most important thing. Everything else stems from there. It's kind of that's sort of the primary silver bullet, and then all the other lead bullets come into play. But anyway, Stefan, this was super, 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 super educational for me. I really want to dig into some of the IP stuff. Let's 100% do a part two. I'll drop you a line and we can figure out when we do that. And we'll either put them together or do them separately. Do you have any other final comments quickly now that you want to mention before we wrap this up?
No, I guess my main activity lately has been involvement with this Open Crypto Alliance, which is opencryptoalliance.org. And it's Open Crypto X on Twitter. And we are a group of people, technologists and Bitcoin business types and patent attorneys. And we're trying to come up with ways to help combat the patent threat to the blockchain crypto Bitcoin ecosystem posed by several people and entities that are amassing large numbers of patents that purport to cover aspects of Bitcoin technology, which is a big threat to Bitcoin or to people. It's not a threat to Bitcoin any more than the state is a threat to Bitcoin. They can't kill it. They can slow it down and they can hurt it, and they can hurt people in it. They can hurt businesses and miners and individuals, which is bad. I'm working. That's one of my passions right now. So any Bitcoiners who are concerned about its viability and its speed of adoption and all that, just take a look at Open Crypto Alliance.
Awesome. All right, Stefan, thank you again very much for coming on. I would really look forward to doing a number two. And okay. Yeah, man, enjoy the rest of your day, buddy. Thank you.
I'd be happy to. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.